You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, everyone, super excited about today's episode. We're getting the opportunity to speak with David Houser, the author of the book Unstoppable. And this episode, I mean, it's multifaceted. David went through life with a learning disability, recognized the limitations, and figured out how to succeed and thrive with that set of maybe perceived limitations. Went to school for entrepreneurship, built a business while he was in school, scaled it dramatically, and sold it with his co-founder for a combined $200 million. So you can do the simple math there. I mean, absolutely incredible levels of success that he achieved in the business world. What's so interesting is with his story, you see him, and in particular in the book, you see him fighting this one thing in the background throughout this business building journey, struggling with his health and fitness and getting to this point of balance in his life and really going to extreme measures to try to prove that he could do this. The amazing thing was throughout the process, he was actually able to take that decision-making framework that many times you use in business and actually apply that to the choices that he was making with health and fitness, coming up with this framework that we're going to discuss today, somewhat in the context of diet and keto. And essentially, though, it is this arc of progressively getting better. And I think for many of us, as we're on our own personal journey towards self-improvement, being able to have a framework that we can apply to that iterative decision-making process will be incredibly valuable. So I'm very excited about this episode, and help me with this. I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing quite well. And this is a book about life optimization. And that's what we look at as FI generally, right? This is a life optimization strategy. And it's interesting that so many of the things that David has experimented with over the last handful of years plus are things that I've been working on in my own life. And when I heard him on the Noah Kagan Presents podcast, I said, this is a kindred spirit. This is a FI guy at heart. Regardless of those big numbers that you hear, at heart, this is a FI guy. He has credit card rewards points. He's talking about cash flow on a monthly basis, even though he has literally $100 million in the bank. I think what I really want to dive into is the psychology of this. David talked about having something to fill the gap after selling this business you've been working on for so long. So with that, David, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. And the time with Noah was really interesting. Like he asked a lot of pressing questions. But yeah, I mean, I totally agree. Like it's been very hard, that transition, and we'll definitely talk about that.
So David, one of the things that comes through when I'm reading your book is that you have this OCD component to your life that just drives you in all these different areas. But I think if we were going to go back and look at your childhood, one of the things that you said first is you realized even in grade school that you were dealing with a learning disability. So I think part of our story has to be like that when you have that realization, what did you do with it?
Yeah. So for me, like there was two things that really came from that. One, I think I had this drive very early on of everyone feel like they were always ahead of me, right? So I always felt like no matter what I did, I was behind. I was the kid that wasn't smart enough. So it created this ongoing drive in my life to prove everyone wrong. Now that I look back at this many years later, I can see how important that drive was to my success, right? Without that, I would not have gotten to where I am today. And someone asked me like, you know, what's your motivation? And motivation shifts over time as you get more wealth, but that's been my motivation for the last 20 years. And then number two was really learning how to learn. This was the biggest realization outside of just hard work, because when you have a learning disability, having to go to tutoring 5 days a week and be outside of what everyone else is doing is just a lot of hard work, is understanding how I learn. So when I ended up going to college, I didn't take notes. I didn't read the books very much because the way I learned is very from, you know, listening and hearing and seeing and doing. So that's what I focused my time on. So people would be spending the whole night studying and I would just ignore that, because if I didn't learn it and pay attention in class from listening to the teacher, then it wasn't happening. It didn't matter how many times I read the book. You know, so I utilized that throughout my entire journey again and again.
David, one thing that's so important in life is the identity, the story that we tell ourselves about ourselves. You're talking about this drive that they were ahead of me, this elusive they. Obviously, you've had success beyond most people's imaginations. Does that ever go away? Is it something you want to go away even?
Yeah, so I don't think it ever goes away. To some extent now, I wish that maybe it did a little bit as I spend more time kind of self-reflecting and understanding what's more important to me. And I shift my focus more to about legacy. What do I want to be known for? You know, what do I want to give back to my kids and my family and things like that? But still, that's the drive that pushes me every day. And as much as I want to be present in the moment today, and we talk about mindfulness and all those good things, you know, I still compare myself to others as a success metric, because that's what was built for me when I was young. And it's the only thing I had. And now that I've been able to achieve some levels of success, I can now point back to that and say, I told you so, you were wrong.
So obviously, you know, the 9 digits in the bank account certainly helps, right? But like after selling the company and that being so part of your identity for so many years, is there any hole there? Like, is there any, hey, I've got to build another business bigger than Grasshopper to prove them wrong? Like, does that go through your mind too?
A little bit. I think about more now is the joy and the happiness I had when I was building Grasshopper. And that's what was missing when you sell it. And how proud I was when we had 45 employees and we were building something great with them. And it wasn't the number 45, but it was the impact we had on lives and the things that we were doing to support them. And that type of joy and happiness, you just don't get if you're not building a company. So I think that part is missing. And to me, it's much more about identity too, where maybe today the success and the metric of the dollars doesn't matter as much, but the idea that I am part of something and I'm doing something that's great and I believe in and I have passion for is really, really important. And when you sell a company and you don't get back into that, there is a big gap missing. And I think that's what relates to happiness more than anything.
Let's talk about building a company, just because this is such a huge piece of your identity, was, and I would imagine is. You're in college, you're there to learn, you're there to get skills. Where did the idea to start a business come from? Did you always know it was going to be entrepreneurship? Just talk us through the mindset that got you there, the why of business building for you.
Yeah, so I always knew I was going to be an entrepreneur. I went to Babson College because their program focused on entrepreneurship. It was the only one in the United States that had a real genuine focus and a major in entrepreneurship, while other people had business programs. So I knew that I was going to be an entrepreneur without question. And then looking at the actual business, I had built a lot of little businesses before college. I had been involved in some internet businesses and other things. And the idea for Grasshopper was actually quite simple, which was me and my business partner both had other businesses that needed this solution, a phone system that made us sound more professional so we weren't picking up our cell phone. And in doing that, we just created this very quickly based on our own needs. We should have done much better in terms of research, and we had a business plan and that stuff because we were in school, but it was not formally laid out. We just really started building what we wanted and went from there.
Can I ask you mechanically, was this your industry? This was your skill set building this software, or was it, I have an idea, can I bring a team in to build it? Like, I know that's kind of nuanced and in the weeds here, but legitimately, I think so many of us say, I think it'd be really cool if this existed, but I don't have that skill set. So just get stuck there.
Yeah, we had zero experience with phones other than using them, like picking up a phone and using it, right? Like, we had no idea what the technology was like. We didn't know anything about it. And we didn't have enough money to bring in a team when we started. So we just had enough money from past businesses, like $150,000. The first kind of invoice for the hardware we needed was like $250,000. So we had to convince the vendor to give us terms and credit and all this stuff. And we were bringing in T1 lines and plugging them into physical machines. This was before companies like Twilio and such. So when I hear people say that today, I'm like, come on, like there are so many easier ways to do stuff than when we were starting, because there's platforms that, you know, democratize access to all this stuff. Like, just take a step forward. This is what I tell people all the time. And you'll learn something, right? Maybe we would have failed at telecom. Maybe the whole thing didn't work. But if we didn't take the first step forward of starting to build something, nothing would have happened.
So, yeah, I mean, we constantly say here, taking action is everything. It's easy to have ideas, but you have to actually take that step forward, get up off the couch and do something. So with this inception point, was it, hey, we know we want to do something, let's find the idea? Or was it, hey, we've got this idea, do you want to partner? Let's do this type thing. I know, again, that's kind of maybe splitting hairs, but I'm curious at that point of inception, what this looks like.
It was definitely, we have this idea, let's do it, not let's find an idea. And I think to me, that's one of the biggest differentiators in successful businesses. We can all talk to MBAs and discuss like, how do we do opportunity generation and identification and all these things. And yeah, that works sometimes. But the most interesting and best businesses I've ever seen come from a genuine pain point that I'm solving for myself more than even for others, right? Because I genuinely know what it is. I don't have to worry about customer interviews and doing all of this discovery, right? It's something I'm solving for me today.
So David, I wanted to ask about this major in entrepreneurship at Babson College. A, how did you find this? Like, how at 17 did you know, wow, I want to be an entrepreneur? What do they teach? What does that look like? And yeah. I mean, do you think it's a learnable skill? Is it iteration? What does this look like?
Yeah, so I have a very controversial view on this. I firmly believe you cannot teach entrepreneurship. I think it's something that's inherently within someone. It's a combination of being able to understand and take on risk, as well as calibrate that risk against the reward. And it's just not something you can teach. What you can, however, teach is a lot of the skills that make you a better entrepreneur, like reading a balance sheet and a profit and loss statement, like understanding how to be a manager and how to be a good manager, understanding how to hire and fire, a lot of the tactical hows that otherwise you'd have to go out into the world and learn. And yes, like the classroom's not perfect, but having that starting out was far better than me having to spend 5 or 10 years working inside of a large company to discover some of these learnings. And I think that's where something like Babson and a lot of schools now have become far more valuable. So in my mind, when they say the word entrepreneurship, it's much more about the tactics and the processes and the things behind being an entrepreneur compared to being an entrepreneur. And I think a lot of people, even Babson to some extent, wastes a little bit of time on this, let's build a business plan together and let's like run a business together and, you know, trying to generate those skills. And I understand why it's important, but it shouldn't be the focus.
Let's play this out just while we're staying on this train of thought a little bit longer. You graduate, you are now you have a degree in entrepreneurship. So go off and build. What do you build?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so I started the business in college. So for me, I was building when I was in college. So I was ignoring half the classes and just doing something. And I think that's the most powerful way to learn. But yeah, I mean, look, most people that leave Babson don't actually become entrepreneurs on their own. They take an entrepreneurial role within another organization. And we've even hired people from Babson. And I think they're great employees when you need someone that has that business background and that entrepreneurial mindset, but they might not be an entrepreneur, right? They're not able to take that risk and step out and do it on their own. Or maybe they don't have the strategic thinking and the other pieces that become important as being an entrepreneur. I meet a lot of people that are great executional-wise. They're great within a business. But if you set them out and said, you have to build a strategic plan for this business, it falls apart right away.
I have one more follow-up on this just because we live in a world of unicorns with massive amounts of venture capital and crazy IPO valuations. This is a fantastic week for it, frankly, here starting in October, just looking at it as it all crumbles. But it is the world in which we live. But having said that, I hear so many entrepreneurs talking about the cost of a customer and having these crazy numbers where anything will justify it, got to get the customer, and we got all this venture capital so we can afford it. I'm just curious with you, with this mindset, this frugal mindset that is starting this while in college, is doing this at a super lightweight level, what's your perspective on, like, if you're going to do it now, does it take VC? Does it take significant funding? How do you interact with a startup business with relatively lean cost out the gate?
Yeah, so we were 100% bootstrapped. So I believe in this fully. There is zero reason to take on venture capital today, except in very limited circumstances in double-sided marketplaces and things that really require first mover advantage. But there's so few of them that it's crazy. I think the problem is we live in this world of the media telling us that the most successful people have taken money, so everyone has to take money. And then you're on this ongoing train. So I tell entrepreneurs all the time, and this is a difficult position because I also make investments, they should not take investment. they should go as long as possible taking zero money, building a profitable business with positive unit economics. And the beauty of not taking money is you can't have messed up unit economics like all of these IPOs we've seen where they're just losing money. When it's your money, it just doesn't happen. So there's no like having to tell someone that. And I think that the celebration that we see around these unicorns is tremendously negative for the entire entrepreneurial community. And I wish there was more focus on the companies that not only bootstrap, but take a long time to be successful. We sold Grasshopper 12 years into the business.
Were you and your partner on the same page with that growth strategy from the very outset?
Yeah. So me and my business partner were very aligned on this. We just wanted to build something great that we loved being at. Like that was our goal. We had no exit plan. We had no desire to sell the business. Even when we did sell it, it was after a year and a half of saying no, 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 no. And our goal was very specific. Like we want to be at a company that we love being at and we're proud of.
So David, you talked in this prior interview that I heard you on about this quote frugality problem that I have. And I laughed out loud when I heard that.
Sold a business for $100 million, frugality problem.
Yeah, frugality problem. But I get it. I mean, I think a lot of us, we have our mindset and it's hard to break that. You know, obviously you see positives of it in your life, I suspect, by building this company that was high margin, high profits, you know, all the smart way, in my estimation as well, to build a business. So there are clearly positives of it, but you wouldn't refer to it as a frugality problem if there wasn't a dark side. So I'd love to hear you kind of talk through how you've grappled with this.
Yeah. So I think it's a problem that externally people have always pointed out, calling me cheap or whatever. I really think it comes down to a very specific mindset, which is when you look at a budget, there's one group of people that believe you should increase the amount of money coming in and that solves the problem. And there's another group of people that believe you should lower the expenses. Right. And obviously the right answer is somewhere in the middle, right? Like we do increase revenue and we do decrease expenses. However, I am much more on the side of decreasing expenses, especially when it comes to personal. So in the business, I'll happily spend tremendous amounts of money testing and discovering and failing and doing all sorts of things. Like we lost $1 million trying to build some businesses within Grasshopper. So I had no fear of losing money there. But at home in my personal life, I will happily cut expenses as far as possible. And I think when I start to describe it as a problem is when I spend more time than it's worth to reduce the expense. So take example, like the internet bill at home. Yeah, I can reduce it by $30 a month. It probably takes me about an hour of work. Is it really worth me doing that? I don't know. I enjoy doing it, so I do it anyway.
And I'm not going to not do it.
But is it really the right reward for that amount of time spent on it? Maybe not. So I think that's where the problem starts to come.
Did you find that, I guess, your spending in the business, did that help your mindset to help kind of moderate at all your irrationally frugal side in your personal life? I know personally, I've found that it has. You know, we have equipment here for Choosify that Jonathan loves to spend on, and I see the value in it. I think for the first time, like, I really genuinely see value in purchasing things. And I think it's helped me kind of loosen up a little bit, you know, from maybe being over that line, whatever that line is to you. But, you know, to me, I was slightly over the line of irrationally frugal. And I don't see that about myself anymore. I'm curious, have you seen any evolution on your side?
Yeah, I mean, I think within the business, it helped me see a much more direct line to the benefit compared to personal. Like in the business, it was much more direct. Spend this, get that, right? And obviously, you can do that in marketing. But then as you start to invest in things, you can see that direct response from one to the other. Where in my personal life, it's a little bit harder to do that. So yeah, I mean, I think it helps. I don't think it changed my mindset because still within the business, every quarter, even at the size before we sold the business, I would go through line item by line item, every credit card charge, and people would get annoyed every time. David's at it again, and he's asking what this is for. But in reality, like that's also when you discover you have 7 subscriptions to Basecamp when you need one. And like at scale, those things start to add up. But yeah, I think people got annoyed with me over time as I continue to do that, but it never stopped even in the business.
Brad, I don't want you to stop, man. You're great.
Jonathan is laughing to himself here because that is exactly what I do.
You know what? I respect what he does though. I've never held it against you. Okay. Can I just say that for the record? All right. Hey, I want to pivot here just a little bit just because these pain points, your frugal problem, quote unquote, are very reminiscent. That pattern showed up in other areas of your life. This book that you wrote, Unstoppable, Four Steps to Transform Your Life, is largely dedicated to your maniacal driven desire to just be able to feel balanced with regards to your health and fitness. And it's one of those where, like, you see the things that you tried and they're insane. Like, this is my goal. To do what you were actually doing would be my aspirational goal. If I was able to do what you did, I would say, okay, that's winning, but you're doing it and you're miserable. And when it comes to doing Ironmans, you're miserable. When it comes to your dieting tactics, you're miserable. How can you be at that level of fitness, quote unquote, and simultaneously just be imploding internally? And so it looks to me like you wrote this book almost as a process of journaling, or maybe retroactively journaling this experience. And I'm curious, like, you know, if you were to go back, tell our audience, what is going on behind the scenes? Yes, your business is crushing it, but going on behind the scenes psychologically with your mindset with regards to your health and fitness, where are you on this journey?
Yeah, so I think the common theme that I saw throughout this, and it comes up even in this frugality thing, is kind of this extreme measures I go to, right? Like, I do nothing halfway. So take, for example, dieting's not working. So I'm told, everyone says, go to the gym. Okay, I go to the gym. I do an hour. It's not working. I'm like, well, if everyone says go to the gym, it must be the right thing to do. So let me just double down on that. I'm going to do more of it. And, you know, in a very short period of time, from never running outside, you know, besides being a kid running around in the yard, but like never doing track and field or any of those things, to running Boston Marathon in a 3.5 month period. The same with Ironman and triathlon. Like, I hadn't ridden a road bike in my life. I had ridden like mountain bikes around town and stuff at the beach or whatever, to riding 7 to 10 hour rides. And I think that appears again and again in my journey, even to the extreme. Now I practice yoga 6 to 7 days a week, but that happened kind of on the same trajectory of zero, doing none of it, to doing it 6 days a week, doing a 200-hour teacher training in the first 6 months. That can be positive and negative in a number of ways. For me, I've seen a lot of positive results only when I direct it towards positive things, right? And I could easily direct that same extreme viewpoint and kind of going way overboard to the wrong things. And what's worked for me is directing it to the right things.
Yeah, to me, what jumped out was kind of split testing, A-B testing, looking for not just the general, oh, this is how everybody does it, so therefore it has to be good, right? You said, quote, my new assumption was that no set of dietary guidelines or nutritional framework I'd followed in the past was correct. And you just wanted to experiment. And I think that's incredibly laudable, because so many people, I know my own parents get stuck in this. They followed the nutritional guidelines for 30 years, and yet nothing's getting better, probably quite the contrary, but they're not iterating. And I think a lot of people get caught in that. Like, if you're not seeing results, even by doing, quote unquote, the right thing, it might be time to shift a little bit.
And so many of us think, well, we're doing something wrong. Like, I'm the problem. And I think that comes through in your book. Initially, it was all self-blame. Oh, it's me. I'm not doing it right. This is what the standards say. I'm not doing it right. But what's cool, to your point, is you iterated out of that.
Yeah, I mean, look, like, this is the rut that most people get stuck in, which is either I'm not doing enough or I'm doing too much in terms of eating. Like, I'm not doing enough exercise, or I'm eating too much, right? Or I'm eating the wrong things. And it's all about personal blame, where really what it to me became is what we are being told could be wrong. That's the key. Maybe it's right. Maybe it's wrong. I don't know. But until I opened my mind and said there is a possibility that it could be wrong, I wasn't even willing to test other things. Once I was willing to test other things, I quickly discovered for me, those were wrong. And I think the difficulty with this book even is I could sell far more books if I came up with, like, just eat broccoli and do nothing else, right? Like, very extreme, you know, kind of kitschy and easy, right? However, the truth is not that. The truth is you need to find what works for you from a diet perspective, an exercise perspective. And for me, yeah, high fat, relatively ketogenic diet works tremendously well for me. Do I say that works for everyone? No, absolutely not. Someone else, a totally vegan diet may work for them. For me, it didn't. But if I hadn't opened my mind to saying maybe there's a different way than what I've been told, I wouldn't have tried either of those.
I want to go to in the book where you actually create the framework for having those conversations with yourself, because I think that's one of the more useful things in this is if we're saying that there's no absolute truth when it comes to health and fitness, if it's not just calories in, calories out, if it's not just vegan all the time, if it's not just fat all the time, if it's you're a unique individual, what are the questions that an individual should start to ask in order to get started on their own journey of self-discovery?
Yeah. So I wish that I could say like I came up with this crazy framework on my own. Look, I just stole this from any sort of continuous improvement or A/B testing framework. So identify the issues, prioritize them, define experiments, go through, actually do the experiments, measure and test, and then integrate those experiments back into your process, or in our case, when we're talking about our lives, our routine. And throughout these steps, you just continuously do this. Now, there's lots of nuances in there and lots of little things. However, it's very, very simple at the highest level. Define an experiment that you want something to change. Do the experiment, see what happens, learn from it. And if it was positive, you just you keep doing it again and again, and then you experiment on something else. And I think the key is these can be big or small. It doesn't have to be major changes. I actually encourage people to think about smaller changes first, because building on that, kind of just taking action, doing a few small changes and seeing the positive results, I think just gets people kickstarted on the process and bought into it really fast.
What would be the first or a couple of quick hit things that people could experiment on that would have a high value for potentially little input, let's say.
Oh, what you're saying is, what is the Pareto's principle of this process? Is that
what you're, 80-20. Like thank you, sir.
Yeah. So let's talk about sleep first. Just going to bed earlier, right? So go to sleep between 9, 9:30, maybe 10 o'clock at the latest. Wake up naturally early when the sun rises. Just kind of happens when you go to bed early. Don't eat within 3 hours of bed, right? Like, all very small changes have very little impact on anyone else in your life, have tremendous positive benefits. On the other extreme of things, I'd say deleting social media from your phone, getting rid of news, especially television news. I think it's toxic. Those types of changes, I think, can have tremendous benefits. And we can kind of go through a diet, the most easy thing, just stop eating sugar. I mean, like,
it's so simple.
we can talk about lots of stuff and there's lots of extreme measures to take, but just don't eat sugar and refined sugars.
I love it. All right. So let's take how you applied this framework. What did this experimentation process look like for you? You're at Grasshopper, you're working out all the time because you feel this, all right, I need to be working out more. I'm the problem. I need to be eating less, or I'm the problem. Or now you're working out because you can eat. Like, how did this actually play out as you were going through this process with your own health and fitness?
Yeah. So it went kind of through this big arc, which was followed all of the guidelines to extremes, right? Cut out all red meat, ate a super low fat diet, exercised 30 plus hours a week easily, if not more. And I remember the moment very specifically, being at an Ironman, putting on the spandex shorts, you know, getting ready for the race. And I'm like, why do I have fat hanging over these spandex shorts? This is not right. I've done everything possible to an absolute extreme, and it's not working. And that's when everything changed. And I started saying, now I'm going to take this A/B testing framework from the business and apply it to myself. And I started with the most simple thing, which was diet. And I just started testing every diet, because diet's acceptable to test, right? Like, if you tell people I'm testing with sleep, they're like, that's really weird. What's wrong with you, right? If you tell people I'm doing a new diet, they're like, oh, that's cool. Which one? So I just started there, and I tested all sorts of things across the board. I probably tested 15 or 20 different things. And again, the turning point was saying, I want to find something so extreme that people question it to see if that will work. And that's how I ended up with trying vegan and keto, like the most extreme things, right?
Yeah, that's interesting. So did you go in with any preconceived notions, or would that kind of screw up the test in essence? Did you do research to have some sense of here are some options, or was it just here are 15 different diets, let's do each for 3 months and let's rock and roll?
I mean, I think when I got towards the end, when I was looking for the most extremes, I spent more time researching than otherwise compared to the beginning. And especially when I started looking at a keto diet, because lots of people raise a lot of concerns about it. I actually don't believe any of those concerns are valid, but that's for each person to decide. And yes, there is a difficulty, and I did go in thinking that a keto diet would work, because based on the data and other people's experiences, it seemed to be the right direction. But the data doesn't lie. The Wi-Fi scale that I get on doesn't lie. I could fake it and tell myself, oh yeah, it worked, but you can't do that to yourself.
I think also just having some connection between the food you put in your mouth and how you feel. Mm. So many people miss that. I've determined, and I'm ashamed to say, especially in light of this conversation, though hopefully this will make me change in a positive way, like I am 100% sure I have some food allergies because I have an issue. I feel inflammation after certain foods. I feel like my throat is a little bit closed up for a couple hours. It's nothing that's terrible enough that has forced me to make any significant changes. But I'm like, you know what? A smarter person would probably experiment here. And it's kind of cool, actually, to know that. I mean, maybe that's the larger thought of this is so many of us just go through life and we just sleepwalk. I love this concept of testing just to challenge assumptions that you might not even know there's something wrong.
I think what I found, too, is that we get worse and worse, but very small amounts, right? So each day, it's a little bit worse. So we're like, it's not as bad. It's almost the same as yesterday. But if we think back to 15 years ago, we're like, oh, my God, like, what happened? I can't sit down easily on a chair. Like, that doesn't happen overnight. It happens little by little, right? And I think food is the same way, where most of us go through life assuming that being bloated and having gas and stomach upset and all of these things is just normal and it should happen. Well, it shouldn't. And being lethargic after a meal shouldn't happen. The body is not made that way. However, over 15, 20, 30, 50 years, we've been conditioned that that's okay.
There's two questions that I kind of want to set you up just to kind of hear your thoughts on this now. One is weeding out correlation versus causation with what you're doing here. I want to hear your thoughts on that just because when you start throwing all these variables at the wall, it's really hard, I would imagine, to pin down and say, yes, that was it. That was it right there. It could just be the sugar.
Absolutely. And I struggle with this on an ongoing basis, right? Because being me, like, I want to speed up and go faster and faster. And I'm like, I want a new pillow and a new mattress at the same time and the cooling thing and the heavy blanket. And the way I justify this is I step back and say, look, if I believe that I'm making multiple positive changes, that I'm okay keeping all of them, I'll do them at the same time. So if knowing that I'm going to replace my mattress anyway and my pillow, I'll do both of them. And then I'll decide which one might have had a more impact. But yeah, it's very difficult. And this is why this process is not perfect, because it's all about personal experience, right? I can look at and read a study. And honestly, the study doesn't really matter that much unless it says, like, I have a high risk of dying based on doing this, right? Like, that's clearly something you would not do. However, outside of that, I want to know how my body feels, how I respond to it, and what happens on a day-to-day basis. So kind of keeping track of that is important. But yeah, you're never going to fix this. Like, you can't isolate everything.
The other thing I wanted to ask about, and actually just comment on, that I noticed was the verbiage mindfulness, intentionality, and kind of contrasting that with grazing. And I think you use this language, which is replicated in my own life. I don't know why, but I treat eating a meal like a competition. I just, no one else is around me. I'm not going to look up until it's over. I'm probably not going to breathe until it's over. You know, who am I racing? I'm not sure, but I never take the time to analyze the texture or the taste of my food. I just reflexively comment after it's done. And I feel like one of the things that you, as a part of maybe the yoga, as a part of the journaling process, as a part of all the different variables, one of the things you latched onto was, am I actually being mindful when it comes to my actual meal? And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that. And also if you've been able to maintain that.
Yeah, I struggle with this on an ongoing basis because I am the guy that eats just as fast as you, trust me.
We could have meals together. It would be entertaining to watch or not watch, you know? Oh my goodness.
The restaurants love it because they can turn a table really fast, yes. Right? And my mom always joked with me about it, but I still struggle with this. And for me, the biggest change, well, there's two of them really. One is I try not to eat at my desk anymore because that was just a bad habit of absolutely taking away all concentration and eating at my desk while doing something else. So now I try to at least step away and not do that. That's been one thing that's helpful. The other thing, it sounds ridiculous. However, it is probably the most helpful thing is I shifted from using a microwave to using a steam oven to reheat my meals because all my lunches and a lot of my dinners, I kind of pre-prep. The difference is in the microwave, it takes a minute and 30 seconds and it pretty much kills all the nutrients and we can talk about why that's not good or whatever. But the steam oven takes 20 minutes and it just slows everything down. I have a chance to detach from the work. I have a chance to think about, okay, this is the food I'm going to eat. It makes me slow down before I even start the meal. And between those two things, it's been helpful, but I still struggle with this. I'll go out to dinner and just eat tremendously fast, or, you know, race through a meal at home because I want to get some work done or I want to spend time with the kids. It's an ongoing struggle.
I feel like if you can apply mindfulness right here, if you make this your battleground, you know, that is that's a Pareto's principle. That's an 80-20 thing right there, just because there's spillover effects for the rest of the evening, the rest of the day. And I know this just from maybe personal experimentation without the journaling afterwards, that when I feel like I'm in most control of my health and fitness, inevitably I am not just chowing my food. You know, it's a process. My mother-in-law, we actually tease her because she takes 45 minutes per meal, you know, and it's honestly, if you look back, you're like, okay, I see the upshot of that.
Nice conversation. You can actually talk during a meal. Who would guess?
And you might actually taste the food and remember what it was and enjoy it. And ultimately, you eat less, right? Because your body knows that it's full. And I mean, there's all sorts of things. That
there's
happen.
A sensation of being full. I could never imagine. David, I've got a couple quotes here that really stuck out to me. Indulge me here to let me read both of them. Your message, as you said, is to enjoy life. Don't be dogmatic. Don't be unreasonable. Just enjoy every day. Make common sense decisions. And don't be the jerk in the room that needs to have a special meal or a special dish. And then a couple pages later, you said, and remember, control doesn't mean restriction. Control is the freedom from frustration. And I just love that. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that sentence in particular.
Yeah. So that one, I think, applies a lot when I think about like alcohol. I used to drink. I don't drink anymore. That's a personal choice. When I think about it now, it's much less about, do I drink, yes or no? It's like, if I drink, do I understand the impact? And am I willing to take that impact on? Which is very different from saying no one should ever drink. Like, that's a ridiculous statement. And I think that's what we see so much again and again in all of this advice, compared to what I'm saying is, think about it, understand the risks. And then if you want some fried food, go eat some fried food because you enjoy it. What good is it if you went through all of life saying, oh, I wish I had a slice of pizza, and then you die? That kind of sucks. But also understanding that when you eat that pizza, there's an impact. Maybe your stomach's upset the next day because you're lactose intolerant. There's lots of things that could happen, but just take it on with your eyes open.
And is that what allowed you to release the self-guilt and shame at the loss of pride? I mean, I'm just playing this, right? That, wow, I was doing so good this week. I made it 6 times to the gym and I was perfect and I've ruined it. I've undone an entire week. Like, what allows you to remove the guilt from the enjoyment of that? You know, even if it's an intellectually honest decision, separating that out is a process for people, I feel.
Yeah, I think there's two things. One is understanding that some of this stuff goes beyond personal responsibility. So some of it's just inherently how our body operates. So understanding how that works and then working with our body to, you know, kind of work in concert. Once you move past that, you can then separate out and step back and say, I will make decisions for me on my own. And it's not about having a cheat day. And that's why, like, I hate when people say, like, every week I have a cheat day. I'm like, you're literally building in failure to start out with, rather than just stepping in and saying, today I'm making a choice because I want to enjoy ice cream today. Okay, cool. That's a much better choice than today's a cheat day, so I'm just going to eat a bunch of crap.
I want to actually circle back to the food pyramid. I'm not particularly interested in parsing whether or not keto is a perfect diet or vegan, but what I do want to do for this example is, I think we can all say that sugar is bad. And that information has kind of been hidden for us from a long period of time, unnecessarily. The food pyramid is a politically motivated thing. There has been a misinformation campaign that has been passed down to us for decades. Finally, we're starting to be able to kind of see patterns. I think a lot of the, you know, voices are starting to break through, but now it's almost to the point of like overwhelm, where it's not really information, but it's noise. So I'm curious, like, in your mind, as a form of self-experimentation, when you take that original basis, which is, hey, I'm going to, and Brad's parents, I'm going to follow the food pyramid to the T. And then 20 or 30 years later, you look back and you're like, well, golly, what happened, right? Help our audience understand, just because of your research that you did to put this book together, why is this food pyramid so devastating for us as a society? Someone that has never heard of the food pyramid until now, why should they care about this?
Yeah, I mean, it has such far-reaching impact. Yeah, I think for me, it's about two things. One is saying, like, look, it could be wrong because we've seen the results. And we can argue about if it's right or wrong. And like you said, if this is the right diet or the wrong diet. Honestly, I think the food pyramid needs two key changes. The first is it needs to be science-based, which it is not today. It is just kind of made up stuff. And two, it should also be there are multiple options, right? It should be very clear that you can pick from maybe two or three options that are based in science and are healthy. And then we can argue about what those are. But the impact that it has that we don't understand is every food manufacturer bases everything they do on this food pyramid. Every statement that is on a piece of food, that anything that's not a whole food, right? Any packaged food is based on this. So what happened was they said, okay, fats are bad, sugars are good. So let's decrease the fat, increase the sugar. And that becomes everything that's available in the supermarket. You could walk in through the supermarket and never have heard the food pyramid, but this has a tremendous impact on your food.
Yeah, I'm still incredulous when I walk into the supermarket and I see foods touting low fat as if like that's some panacea, or healthy whole grains on the same box. It's just antiquated at this point. I think really we need to kind of wake up and realize life has moved on from this food pyramid.
You see a cereal that's tremendously high in sugar and somehow it has the seal from American Heart Association and it's healthy and it's good for you. And I'm like, literally,
they're
you might
great.
As well eat scoops of sugar, right? Like, it's the same thing. And so, I wish that we would see change in that, and it's starting. But this is a big fight in our house because the kids love the food and the snacks they see on television, and that's what's available in the store.
So, David, we talked about food, obviously. We talked about sleep. I know you've mentioned in your book that yoga made you feel better than I'd ever felt in my life. I mean, those are three big aspects of health. Are there any other major items that you'd want to pass along to the audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other big area is supplementation. Supplementation goes a long way for sure, because there's things that we just can't do naturally and that we've learned from studies and other things that are better than what we could do on our own, even from the food we consume. However, I always warn people, like, this is one of the last areas to worry about, because you need to have done blood testing to look at these markers and understand them beforehand, because otherwise you're just buying random crap and consuming supplements and hoping that it does something. And maybe there's a few that make sense, but I do encourage people to think about it as kind of a further step along the journey if they're okay doing blood testing. I, again, obsessively do this. Every quarter, I do a massive set of tests. It's probably, you know, a small blood draw when they come and do it at my house. I think last time was like 50 or 60 vials. I don't encourage people to do that because I don't think it's necessary. I like the data, but it's an area to think about.
I'm going to go and not pick on you per se, but like just pause here, because I do feel like this is one of those that you hear people just drop, oh, supplementation, great. And the more responsible ones will say supplementation, but blood testing, great. But then that's usually kind of the end of the information. And so I kind of want to just pause practically for you. One, you have to find a good supplement company, which is its own rabbit hole, probably its own book. I noticed that you're a little light on which ones were your favorite supplements and this one, which I don't blame you for avoiding, but I'm curious. How does someone find, feel like there's probably two or three on your website. Did you commit to some that you're actually, you know, fans of now?
Yes. So on the website, I did specifically call out the ones in each category that I'm personally taking. So that was my filter. Not just like, here's a bunch of them, but these are the ones that I'm taking today.
Perfect. Right? And I respect the reason to do that, referencing back something that can be updated if you need to update it for any reason. So that totally makes sense. Second question.
But I think there are some important filters. So looking at quality does matter a lot. Brand, there are brands that are known for better quality. Testing is important. But then also just in general, understanding that good supplements are expensive. And not that it's to waste money, right? Like, you don't have to buy the most expensive supplement, but buying the cheapest one is usually not the best choice.
I feel like you put a lot of emphasis on really less than five supplements, which is kind of refreshing that it wasn't 20, wasn't 30. I mean, it's still like more than one multivitamin, but, you know, like it was like five or so. So I'm curious, which ones did you land on that for you, you noticed the benefit?
So I'll tell you what I'm taking today. And most importantly, what I continue to take, because I've tested over time. So I take a D3 vitamin every day. I take two salt pills, which are electrolyte. That's the only supplement I take that's mixed, meaning it's not just one thing. And I'm very careful about that. I don't like multivitamins at all because of what you referenced earlier. Like, I have no idea what's working. And also, if I want to tweak something in my blood, I can't if it's in a multivitamin. So D3, a salt supplement, magnesium included, some sort of fish oil. I take a super high dose of omega-3 fish oil. There's a link on the website for the brand I use today. Then B12, but usually in a B complex because it's a little bit easier. So right now I'm taking a B complex. I used to take a B12 and a B6 and whatever separately. Those are the core ones. Then at nighttime, I take two magnesium pills for helping with sleep. That's it. Nothing else.
One of the reasons that supplementation is interesting to me is just when you get fixated on a diet, it's your energy levels, your lethargy, your need for caffeine in order to get through the day. And I feel like one of the things that all of us are looking for is the effect you can feel. And I mean that usually that's just caffeine. That's just another way of saying caffeine. But I think any diet that works well would be one that you can do without caffeine in your life. That'd be amazing. That would be the ultimate win, to be as energized as I am on caffeine just because of my natural diet. I feel like that's one of the ways that, you know, keto is marketed as providing you that. But then if you're not getting it, then you might start thinking about supplementation. Was that kind of what led you there? Is first you got your diet dialed in and then you were looking correlation, causation, right? How do you know which one is doing it? You get your keto dialed in, you get some benefits, and now you're saying, all right, what else do I need to do? Is that what this looked like for you?
Yeah, so I actually don't drink anything with caffeine. No soda, no coffee, no tea. Never have. So it's not like I cut it out. I just don't drink it. So for me, keto definitely had those things. And I monitored the effect on especially kind of brain fog and feelings and energy later in the day, because that's when I would normally have a drop. It definitely helped with that. However, I would also get sick quite often. Not the keto flu, totally separate. Like before eating keto, I would just get sick. So that's when I started looking at more and more supplementation and saying, what are the things in my blood that may not be optimal? And the easiest ones that came out are D3 and B12. Those have the most effect on feeling, energy, health, even testosterone and sexual function, and those things are all related back to these kind of core nutrients, maybe even magnesium too. But D3 is very interesting when you actually look at the data. For example, I wanted to increase my testosterone levels and I stacked up a lot of D3, two pills in the evening, one in the morning, and just naturally increased my testosterone based on that, because D3 is a precursor to testosterone. So there's a lot of things you can do when you start looking at the blood. But if you haven't looked at the blood, then it's kind of
waste time. I was just going to say to our audience, please don't do this if you're not supplementing and doing this under medical supervision or having a doctor that's checking on you. That's one thing I love about what you're saying is this doesn't make sense to even try this if you're not getting your blood test. If you're already in range for D3, there's no point in becoming toxic. You can become toxic with any of these supplements. And so that's kind of where I wanted to go with this is, what does reasonable levels of testing actually look like for you? So you have a baseline. And then you make changes based on this, where you don't have access to unlimited resources. You don't have access to testing on demand. You can't break the bank on this. This is not, you know, in the 80-20, we're moving outside of that and we're looking more in the what else can I do space now. What is a reasonable amount of time to evaluate the results of this blood test? And what do you imagine that it would cost?
Yeah, so 6 months to a year, I think, is a reasonable interval for most people to do blood testing after a baseline. Now, what's really interesting and nice now is you can do like a D3 only test for like $15 or $20. So if you're targeting just that, you could increase frequency a little bit until you kind of get it to where you want and you know how many pills and you kind of get to that level you want. So I think that's a nice option. But end of the day, like if you want to do a full panel like I do, you're talking probably $500 to $750 if you don't have it covered through, you know, a medical plan or organization. I actually use Parsley Health and they cover a lot of this testing, which is really nice, and have some nice resources and great doctors as well, but they do cover the testing. So yeah, I mean, look, what I do is not reasonable, period. And everyone around me tells me that. But for most people, 6 months to a year, you have no problems.
So David, I feel like throughout the process, you're working out 7 days a week, you're pushing yourself to these extremes. You're about to do this Ironman. And I mean, objectively, in terms of what you can accomplish doing a Boston Marathon, doing an Ironman, I mean, you are already at peak fitness by so many metrics, but you're basically saying that one, you feel like your knees are about to give out at any time. Your joints are killing you. You look down and you feel fat. You just have this sense of self-loathing and shame about this, despite all the effort that you're doing now. As a result of this decision-making framework that you went through and kind of coming out the other side, and you have something that works for you that you don't feel like is making other people's lives miserable, you even allow yourself to have this meal every once in a while. Like, do you still battle with that self-loathing, or at its heart, do you feel like you've come to some point of balance in your life?
This is still an ongoing struggle, to be very honest. I still identify and say, like, I'm fat, right? Like, I've lost 35 pounds. Like, do I want, like, I want this better? Like, you know, whatever, right? However, it's still very hard to change that identification over 20 years. of being overweight and, you know, not loving how clothes fit and those types of things. I'm getting better with it, but it has not gone away at all.
All right. Well, I'm rooting for you. And I honestly do think that what you've put here is a manual. And this book, to me, it reflects like your own journey to transformation and self-discovery. And I think it's a phenomenal primer for individuals. The book is Unstoppable, 4 Steps to Transform Your Life. We'll have a link to it in the show notes. And I'm sure you can find it anywhere the books are sold, David.
Yeah, absolutely. Amazon, anywhere.
Well, I tell you what, on most shows, that would be the end of the episode. But on this show, David, we would love to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, David, question number one, what is your favorite blog or podcast or book of all time?
Yeah, so this is a hard one. I used to listen to a lot more podcasts, and now for me, it's a lot more books. I go back to Sapiens. This is really one of my favorite books. I have a number two that's really close, but this changed my viewpoint on so many things. And Yuval's books after that are good, but just not as great as Sapiens. And this is one that, like, when someone says, like, what book do I have to read? Sapiens.
All right.
Wow. So you're leaving me hanging. What's the number two that's close?
The Evolution of Everything by Matt Ridley. And this is very close with Steve Pinkerton's latest book, Enlightenment Now. It's just a very positive view on how life advances and how today is just, we are so much better than we were before, even though all we hear about is the negative, right? Like everything's falling apart and the world's horrible.
Yeah, I've got one that I read recently called Factfulness, which is actually very similar to that. If you haven't read that, I'd highly recommend it.
I'll put it on my list for sure.
All right. Question number two, David, an inflection point in your life that was especially memorable or meaningful.
Yeah. So this one I had to think about quite a lot. The most meaningful one recently I talk about in the book, actually, which is this change of how I did not feel hungry anymore. And this was just it seems so simple right at the base, but it was just meant so much more to me because throughout my whole life, I struggled with weight and diet and all of these different things. And it all came back to just feeling hungry. And then the guilt that comes from feeling hungry, because I'm like, well, I shouldn't eat, maybe like going back and forth. So that time when I could walk down from my office and feel like, wow, I didn't eat lunch because I wasn't hungry and I just didn't think about it, was just such a change. And I even called it a magical moment in the book because, you know, you go through 30 years of life and you then all of a sudden have something that's totally different.
Wow. Yeah, that's brilliant. I think so many people look at diet and going on a diet as some willpower issue that you have to constantly win. But it sounds like you just came to this point where you'd figured out food that actually satisfied you. And that's a sea change, right?
Yeah, it's just everything's different at that point.
All right, David, question number three, your favorite life hack.
My favorite life hack. So this one, I have so many here, so I had to pick one.
You can give us more than one if they're all good, but you know.
I really love my squatty potty. So my filter to this was like my favorite life hack under $100, right? Because like we could talk about all sorts of crazy things, but I love my squatty potty and baby wipes. Like these are two things that like, if you're not doing this, like you're a caveman at this point. Like, I can't imagine. That would be one. But the other that kind of comes to mind right away, and unfortunately it's $200 instead of $100, is my steam oven. Available on Amazon. It's like made, I forget who it's made by. It's the only one available that's like a small one that sits on the counter. Changed the way I eat, changed like how, like even just enjoying food. Cause when you reheat it in the steam oven, it's just so much better.
All right. Awesome, man. And question number four, the biggest financial mistake that you've made.
Oh, there's so many here. I would say after the success, because I think these are more interesting than prior to selling the company, because at this point, like I should be more advanced in my thought process. I have more money. So like, it seems like that's when I should make better decisions. Investing in restaurants, food, and related types of things have been the biggest mistake, both from a capital standpoint, like losing money, but also from an emotional standpoint. And I think the draw to this is the most interesting part. The reason myself or most people invest in any types of these businesses is because people understand them, right? So I went through 12 years at Grasshopper being very successful, tremendously high profits, great employees, great growth. And someone asked me what I do, and they look at me with a blank face, like when I explain it, like they have no idea, they don't understand. Or when you say, oh, or I have a restaurant, they're like, oh my God, I love food, right?
So we have that in common.
Yeah, it's like easy identifiable and like there's something to talk about. So I think there's this just direct connection, and that's why people will do it. But yeah, I've not a good investment.
All right, question number five, the advice you would give your younger self.
Yeah, the advice I'd give my younger self was really make sure you go out there and do something. Just do one step forward again and again and again. I learned that later on in life, but I wish I had learned that earlier. And I think I saw the inkling of it, right? There was pieces of it, but I didn't understand it. And if it had been crystallized in my mind, I think that would have been helpful.
All right, now we do have a bonus question for you, which you've kind of halfway answered, but we'll give you another shot at it. What purchase have you made over the past 12 months that has added the most value to your life? Please do not say the Squatty Potty. Give me something else, please.
I purchased that more than 12 months okay. ago, so that's an automatic disqualifier. Something I've purchased over the last 12 months, this would definitely be my Uller, which is made by ChiliPad. Just love the product. This is a cooling pad that goes on the mattress. I've tried the built-in ones and everything, but if you're talking about the most impact for sleep and, you know, getting deeper sleep and better sleep, this has had more impact than anything else I've tested. It's not exactly cheap. You know, we're talking about like $600-700. I do have a discount code on my website, but
oh, there it is.
I love it. And I can't imagine another product that would come close to that in the last 12 months.
Awesome. So Uller.
Yeah. How do you spell that?
Right.
O-O-L-E-R. And I fight with this company all the time since when you Google it, it doesn't come up.
Wow. Oh, come on.
Like we can solve this. We can
somebody else took it.
It's like, come on, guys. So it's made by ChiliPad is the name of the company.
Awesome. Okay. David, this has been a genuine pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me, guys. This has been a lot of fun.
Brad, I love this episode. I love that he was honestly vulnerable with us about what he struggles with. I know that, you know, his mindset and the way that he reflected that in this book is something that it resonated with me. I don't know if it's something that you ever just crush. You know, I think I asked him that last question, kind of hoping he was telling me I totally destroyed it, totally beaten. But the fact that he was willing to be honest and say, you know, I'm in a better place, but it's still part of my identity. This book is honest. And I think the fact that someone tells you, like, I'm not perfect, but this is my process that I've gone through and it's been helpful for me and I hope it'll be helpful for you. I can take that at its words and there's some really good information here.
Yeah, agreed. I thoroughly enjoyed the book and this episode. I mean, it was really phenomenal to talk through what this experimentation looked like in David's life. I think we all owe it to ourselves to experiment. You have these massive areas of health and wellness and finances, everything that theoretically, you can get a little bit better, right? We talk all the time, aggregation of marginal gains, right? I mean, you can look at every aspect of sleep, and this doesn't mean go crazy, be a crazy person and spend all your life micro-optimizing, but there are some little things that you can do that would make your life easier. Get a better pillow, blackout curtains, get a
I need to get your link for the blackout curtains.
Yeah, blackout curtains are amazing.
You got that one solved.
Oh man. Yeah, no lights coming into my room, that's for sure. But it's cool. You figure these little things out as you go along. There's no grand plan, at least how I look at it. I think it makes it more interesting and more fun is look at life as an experiment and just try to be a little bit better tomorrow and most, if not all of the tomorrows thereafter.
Absolutely. All right. If you got value from today's episode, just take 1 second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. Just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us and what we're doing here at ChooseFI, here are four easy ways. One, leave us an iTunes review. To do that, just go to choosefi.com/iTunes. Two, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to choosefi.com/cards and get started today. Three, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in Cat. And four, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 100. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.